Thank you. Be seated. Court is ready to hear oral argument from petitioner in Grain Dealers Mutual Insurance Company versus Gerald Wayne McKee and Diana Michelle McKee individually and his next friend of Kelly McGee.
Thank you. Court, Mr. Lyon, will sit down with the petitioner. Petitioner will reserve 5 minutes for vote.
May it please the court. Grain Dealers is asking this court to interpret its business auto policy with its corporate named insured because the courts below found uninsured motorist and personal injury protection coverage in favor of the respondents, the McKees, who are strangers to the policy. The policy consists of a policy jacket, which on its face indicates what comprises the policy. It's made up of the jacket, the inside back page of which constitute the common conditions, the business auto coverage form, the common policy conditions, and the endorsements, if any, that form a part of the complete policy. So on the face of the policy, it shows that it's a business auto policy made up of those parts. The declaration page shows the named insured to be a corporate entity, Future Investments, Inc., and for that matter, all of the endorsement forms that make up the policy show the named insured as the same entity. Policy has six scheduled vehicles. The business auto coverage form at the outset of the policy instructs the policy owner to read the entire policy carefully, to determine rights, duties, and what is and is not covered. Policy goes on to state, throughout this policy, the words you and yours, refer to the named insured shown in the declarations, which is the corporation, Future Investments, Inc. It goes on to state that other words, now if you equals your equals the named insured equals the corporation, then other must refer to something other than the four entities just indicated. It says other words and phrases that appear in boldface type have special meaning, and then it refers to the definition section of the policy. The definition section on insured, and insured is not defined the same as named insured. They're different. Insured embraces named insured, but it doesn't change the meaning of named insured. Under Section 5 definitions under insured, it means any person or organization qualifying as an insured in the who is an insured provision of the applicable coverage.
Counsel, I'm sure you agree that corporations don't have family members.
I do.
Why did you issue an insurance policy that provided for coverage for family members?
Well, the UM and UIM, and for purposes of abbreviation, I'm going to call it UM endorsement, and the PIP endorsement were both issued on prescribed forms. The insurer had to use the forms that were approved by the State Board of Insurance. Now, the argument is made in the court below that when you use family member of you, meaning the CARP, that it has no application, it has no meaning. And then they extrapolate from that and they say that Class 1 beneficiaries under both endorsements then are meaningless, they have no meaning. That's not true. The Class 1 beneficiaries under the UM endorsement are defined as you and any designated person and any family member of either. Now, Texas is a part of its UM statute embraces property damage, and it's not simply a question of bodily injury. The statute covers both bodily injury and property damage. you, in the context of the UM endorsement, under the Class 1 beneficiaries, is not meaningless. It does have meaning. It ensures the corporation as an owner of property for property damage. Now, in the context of the personal injury protection endorsement, that's a little different because it covers bodily injury only. But if you look at the rules on interpretation of contracts, and this court has stated repeatedly that the primary concern of the court in interpreting a contract, and for that matter an insurance contract, is to ascertain and give effect to the intention of the parties as expressed in the writing. And you have canons of construction or interpretation that aid the court in doing that. You look first at the written instrument.
Let me ask you a question real quick. Are you saying that one argument that could be made to demonstrate that this contract is not ambiguous is that the reference to family members under the two endorsements was made solely because these were prescribed forms that the insurance company had to issue?
Exactly. And when you look at the canons of interpretation, Section 203, Restatement Second of Contracts, comments A and B thereunder, they talk about where it's preferable to give a construction to an instrument that doesn't render any part of it meaningless. But if you look at those at comments, the comments recognize that when you use a standard form of agreement, there may be terms and provisions that are surpluses, that don't have application. And there is a distinction between a policy term and provision having meaning and effect and having application. And it's grain dealer's position that all of the provisions of the policy, including the Class 1 definitions in both endorsements, have meaning and effect simply on these facts. They have no application, and the policy is not ambiguous.
Would your position be different if on the first page of the insurance agreement, instead of having corporation checked off, they checked off either partnership or individual? Would you then take the position that family members of the partnership or family members of the individual would be covered?
Well, it would depend on a number of circumstances, but if you simply check that one box, how is the name insured described? Is it described via a corporate name in addition to that? But if you're issuing a policy in the name, in a trade name or an assumed name, which is simply an alias for an individual, then yes, I think the construction would be different. A policy issued to a named insured in that instance, which is the same as the individual, then family member would constitute a family member of that person. Now, when you talk about a partnership, and I think you have to put each of these stand on different bottoms. When you're talking about a partnership, particularly in Texas, where a partnership at times has been described as a combination of persons, and yet in the partnership acts, the general act, the limited act, you borrow the entity concept, and the entity concept has to a great extent permeated the partnership acts. It depends. But in this instance, it was issued, the named insured as a corporation. The policy terms are very explicit.
It's your position that UM or UIM coverage issued to a corporation would provide coverage for property loss but not bodily injury?
Yes.
And that PIP coverage issued to a corporation would provide no coverage at all?
No. You're talking about Class 1 beneficiaries. And under the PIP endorsement, there's a Class 2, and that would be anyone else occupying a covered automobile. The argument has been made in sister states that if you have an endorsement such as this, where these terms are defined in this way, it provides illusory coverage. Well, illusory coverage is not a part of this case because that wasn't made a basis for the summary judgment motion in the trial court. But it, on its merits, it doesn't apply anyway. When you look at who is an insured under both endorsements, you don't isolate a word or a phrase or a part or a section, but you construe it within the four corners of the instrument. And both endorsements provide coverage. There is no illusory coverage.
And under your position, it matters not at all whether Mr. McKee was the sole chairman of the company.
No, and I want to make this point, that if the Court of Appeals was correct and this case was legitimately distinguishable from Webster, which involved an employee, and here you have a president, and arguably we say there's no competent summary judgment proof of shareholder status, but assuming arguendo that there is, then the rationale and the reasoning that underpins the Court of Appeals opinion provides unlimited coverage. Where do you draw the line? Do you draw the line at sole shareholder? Or if it's a small family held company where you have three shareholders, or you have 10, and each of those 10 shareholders has 5 children, or you have a key officer and or director who makes the company go, but who doesn't have an equity position, is not a shareholder, where do you draw the line? That rationale, which the Court of Appeals used, leads to unlimited exposure for an insurer in Texas. The argument that supports that would support extension of coverage to family members in any of those contexts, contrary to the very plain and explicit language of the policy. I want to talk about that meaningless argument. Very briefly, in CSIC, which is the Connecticut opinion that the Court of Appeals relied on very heavily, they talk about a clash of canons. Do you give effect to the plain meaning of the contract, or do you engage in a construction that would render a portion of it meaningless? And the concurring justice there said, well, in the event of a clash of canons, I'm going to opt for the second. But are those canons of equal dignity and equal stature? And I think if you look, you'll find, and the cases from this court have said, no, one yields to the other. In fact, in Strasser, which is cited in the briefs, where you talk about the doctrine of last antecedents, this court stated that if it's indicated that a canon of construction doesn't apply, you don't apply it. And there is that, and under the restatement, where you don't employ a canon to override the evident intent of the parties, results in no clash of canons. I want to reserve some time for rebuttal.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
The court is ready to hear argument from response.
If the court, Mr. Alvear, will present argument for response.
I think that the court in the last three cases in which they've determined interpretation and construction of insurance policies are Forbau, National Union Fire Insurance Company of Pittsburgh versus CBI, and the Beeson case. In each one of those cases, the court has said that intent is of primary importance. Now, first, I'm going to talk about the legislative intent in passing both the UIM, UM statute, as well as the PIP. Any policy in Texas that carries liability insurance has to have UM and UIM coverage. Now, the legislature had as its intent the protection of conscientious motorists from negligent, financially irresponsible drivers. It was for the protection of persons insured thereunder. And incidentally, I'm not going to say a lot about PIP because the arguments on the UM apply equally to the PIP. Now, let's talk about Mr. McKee's intent. I think Streisner pretty well put that to rest. Streisner said that his intent was manifested when he purchased that coverage, both UIM and PIP. Now, I've had this policy blown up, certain portion of it. And I think the court has stated that, number one, it's not the subjective intent of the parties, because we wouldn't be here on summary judgment. If it was subjective intent, we'd be back in the trial court with a fact question for the jury. And this court has made it very clear it's not the subjective intent, it's the objective intent as expressed in this policy. I agree that this policy, at the very first, has, and you all have the pages from the policy there, show that throughout this policy, you and your means named insured.
Now, how would your argument be effective if the corporation had more than one principal?
If it had more than one principal? This is a sole shareholder, president,
I'm asking,
locally.
How would it be effective if there were more than one? If there were two, for example?
It would depend on, number one, what the respective interests were that they possessed and whether they had family members. 50-50. If they had that and the insurance company knew about it at the time that the policy was issued, it's not to be construed in a vacuum. I think that if they both had family members and they met the definition of family members, then they would be covered.
If there were three,
I think it'd be the same.
If there were 2,500.
If there were 2,500, it'd be the same. But that's not the reality of life. It's like the Webster case. They're trying to say that Webster creates unlimited liability on an insurance company. Number one, the Websters did not even come within the definition, which is clear, unambiguous, and clearly defined in the policy in that particular case. They were not family members. They were not residents of the household. They were not wards. They were not foster children.
Does it make any difference? Would it make any difference if a stockholder owned a very small part of the company?
In my opinion, it would. And I'll tell you why.
How small?
Okay. Let me explain to you why I believe it does make a difference. Mr. McKee, in this case, since he's the president and sole shareholder, purchased this policy. He can reasonably expect to be covered under that policy by the definition of the terms used in that policy. Now, the other side has said the reasonable expectations policy does not apply in Texas. Well, there's two cases. One of them is Kelly Associates Limited versus Aetna Casualty Insurance Company, which is quoted in my brief, whereby the court said, furthermore, Kelly could reasonably expect that the bond coverage would extend through the winding up phase of its business. This was a period in which its affairs were in a state of flux and in which it was susceptible to employee misappropriation as it was at any other time. Also, the same wordings were used in the Kublis case. That's the co-insured arson case. The husband set fire to the house. The wife was an innocent party, and the Supreme Court held that she should have coverage, at least for her half interest.
And Mr. Halmedere,
yes.
Let's talk about, I guess, Mr. McKee.
Yes, sir.
The policy says the named insured is the corporation. What about the definitions of named insured indicated that Mr. McKee personally had a liability policy for him?
Okay. If you will look, named insured is used in small letters. I believe you have a copy of the policy where I think it's on the conditions page. There, it also refers to, in boldface types, other definitions have special meaning. Please refer to Section 5, definitions. Now,
let me ask you while you're looking for that. Do you agree that the coverage is for the named insured?
Right. And there is two specific. The intent of this policy, as shown on the face of the policy, is not only to insure the named insured, but is to insure additional insured, because they are defined in the Section 5, which Section 5 definition, which is in boldface type, which is in boldface where it says insured is defined as any person or organization qualifying as an insured under the who is an insured portion of the policy. And I think that's word for word. Now this is out of the PIP. Who is an insured? Now if that doesn't express intent,
does it say
other people besides named insured?
But it says a family member. What does it say is
okay, a family member?
I'm trying to figure out what it is that says that I'm not talking about the family member of Mr. McKee. I'm talking about Mr. McKee. What is it that says Mr. McKee is an insured that otherwise qualifies his family members as insured?
Because of the you.
But you refers to whom?
Well, I think if you'll bear with me, Judge,
okay.
I can show you the reasoning. This is the personal injury protection endorsement. This endorsement modifies insurance provided under the following business auto coverage form, which is what the liability portion of the policy is. This endorsement changes the policy. Now, when it comes down to here, well, that's pretty good. When it comes down to here, it says coverage. This is the insurance clause. The insurance clause does not say named insured. Throughout the insurance clause, the one word insured is used. Now, if you look down here, uninsured, underinsured motorist insurance, Texas standard automobile endorsement. Now when you go over here to the next page, where it says, who is an insured, not named insured, you and any designated person and any family member of either. This expresses their intent.
Yes, and who is the you? You is defined also
in this person being addressed.
Yeah, but
ordinary common person out on the street, even they know that a corporation cannot read a policy. You, as used in plain, ordinary, commonly accepted meaning, as put out in my brief and taken out of Webster, means the one being addressed.
Do you agree with opposing counsel that these forms are prescribed by the state agency?
Well,
just asking, do you agree?
I do. I guess I do agree. But let me show you something more. In the Ramsdale case, and in the Briggs case, and the Frazier's case, this court prohibited this clause right here. That's called an other insurance clause, excess escape clause, pro rata
done in 1972, again affirmed in 74, and again in the Strasner case, and it's still in their policy.
Opposing counsel's brief cites a number of out-of-state cases, as does your brief.
Right.
And the Court of Appeals relied, as has already been noted, heavily on a Connecticut Supreme Court case.
Right.
The opposing counsel's brief claims that the majority rule in the jurisdictions that have considered this issue is against you. Do you agree with that or not?
No, I do not agree with that because the policy conditions are different. And I pointed that out in my brief. There is a difference.
Principal insured as first name in the declaration. They don't have you and any designated person and any family member either. And they say something about designated person. They don't even write designated person policy. Haven't for years.
Who's that?
Frank Evers.
Let me ask you this.
Yes, sir.
Let's assume hypothetically that instead of the corporation being listed as the insured, that Mr. McKee was listed as the insured for this policy.
Okay.
And assume also that instead of having his family, that Mr. McKee is single, has never been, never will be married, and his parents and siblings are all deceased. The same endorsement would still be issued with the family member language in there. Mm-hmm. But in that situation, that family member language would have no effect.
I agree. But I think there's one canon that you all forget. Number one,
Mr. P did not create this mischief.
What I'm saying, would that mischief not also be in there, though, if this had been issued to him individually? Meaning that this is a prefabricated form that the insurance company was required to use, and they can neither add to nor delete from it.
Mm-hmm.
Do you disagree with that proposition?
If he didn't have family members,
well,
the family member provision would not apply. Yes, that is correct.
And what about the second proposition? And that is that when this insurance policy was brought to the company, it was prefabricated, and the insurance company could neither add to nor delete from the endorsement.
Oh, I don't think that that's true, because this court has held that even though the State Board of Insurance may prescribe the form, if it doesn't comply with the legislative intent, then it's void. They did that in Ransell. They did it again in Briggs. They have not been hesitant to do that.
If a company, a large corporation, came into Texas today to get a business auto policy, what form would they be buying insurance? Would it be the same form?
I'm not a sophisticated underwriter, but I know that they do have sophisticated underwriters looking at these policies. They are paid a considerable amount of money to foresee this type of coverage. And you know, they could have secured it very easily
by, number one, deleting this altogether, or in the first part of the endorsement, cautioning policyholders that this refers only to the named insured.
Let's assume they couldn't change. They could not make a deletion. And they could not make an addition.
Well, that's the way I see that.
This language, solely the language that is here, not any argument that something could be changed.
No, wait, I want to make
sure. I'd like you to address your strongest argument without saying if only they had changed this language. And take it just on the language that is before us. In the event that your opposing counsel is right, my understanding is right, that these forms are prescribed and can't be changed.
Well, there's no summary judgment evidence that I know of, before this court that substantiates that.
Well, if the state law prescribes that the insurance commissioner, I guess it is now, back then the commission has to approve the forms, I think the Supreme Court of Texas is free to look at that.
And I agree. And the Supreme Court has also been free on past occasions to void it when it's wrong.
I don't question that, but you're not asking us to void any language out of here, as I understand it. You're just saying the policy's unclear.
I also have a strong public policy argument, I believe, in this case, in that this is about as deceiving as it can come. The average person on the street, not the sophisticated underwriters, not the 9 Supreme Court justices that are hearing this case, the average person out there does not know and would reasonably expect to be covered where this thing has a Texas standard automobile policy, UM, UIM, endorsement, number one. And number 2, it talks about you and family members.
I'm not sure I got your answer to Justice Heck's question earlier. You said that, let's assume that there were 3 shareholders, but one of them owned a very small interest. You said that would make a difference. Can you tell me how and why that would make a difference?
Okay, I'll tell you how and why. There is an old case. It's Commonwealth Bonding and Casualty Insurance Company versus Bryant. It's 240 Southwest, and it's a Texas 1922 case. And in that case, it says, who can doubt that the insured actually believed that he had at least the stated degree of indemnity under the policy, or that the insurer actually intended him to so believe? We are certain that any construction of the language of the policy more favorable to the insurer would not accomplish, but would defeat, the real intent and purpose of the contracting party. I think their intent, which this court has said in the last 3 cases, is objectively on this policy that they had an intent to insure family members.
Well, let's say I'm a minority shareholder. I'm one of the 3 shareholders. I own 2%.
Okay.
And there's this, the named insurer is my corporation, Future Investments, Inc. Am I covered? Are my family members covered?
I don't think so.
And why not?
Because you couldn't reasonably expect coverage. You didn't purchase it for that purpose.
Well, when the president of the company goes and buys a policy for my corporation, which I own a piece of, and it's the insurer that says you and your family members, why wouldn't I reasonably expect to be covered?
Because what I am saying is this case is necessarily fact-oriented. This is concerned the president and sole shareholder. I don't want to get into the can of worms of 2, 3, 4 people.
Well, you may not want to, but that may be the case we hear next year.
Well, if they know that they're writing a policy for that group of people, then they should bear the loss.
So it is a subjective test, not necessarily an objective one.
Well, it'd be a question of law, from my understanding, is it has to be objective. To be subjective, it would have to be a fact question. Am I correct?
So we couldn't look at the face of the policy and decide the issue. We'd have to know what the insurance company knew or what they reasonably should have known.
That'd be fine with me, to go back on intent. That would be perfectly fine with me.
Any other questions?
Yes. If I understand your argument, your position is because in this particular fact situation, Mr. McKee is the sole stockholder, therefore you should ignore the corporate entity in its entirety and conclude that he's the one that's buying the policy, therefore he has family members and they're covered. Is that right?
That's partially right. What I'm telling this court is that this policy ought to be viewed from the viewpoint of the insured as an average person untrained in law and insurance would understand this policy and then endorse it. Because they have taken just one part out of this policy and not considered all parts together.
Mr. Habadir, I think
in many cases, an insurance company sells a policy, there are different coverages that are offered to the insured at an additional premium.
Right.
Is there any evidence in this case of any discernible premium allocated to this disputed coverage? Is that in the record?
I was wondering who was going to ask me that, because that was the first question that Al Chaffin, Chief Justice Chaffin, asked at the fourth court. He candidly admitted the premium would have been no different.
Any other questions? Thank you.
In the court, I did not state in the Court of Appeals that there would be no premium differential, and there's no summary judgment proof as to how the premium was arrived at or a relative comparison of the premiums.
Would it make any difference if grain dealers charged additional premium for this coverage? For this disputed coverage?
I'm sorry?
Would it make any difference if grain dealers charged an additional premium for this disputed coverage?
Well, there was a premium charge for the UM and the PIP endorsements, if that's the court's question. I'm not sure I understand the court's question. But there was not an additional insured endorsement to the policy that included additional insureds. There was a designated person blank in the UM endorsement. And there could have been an individual, and in that case, a designated person was had the same coverage as you, and was a defined term.
Going back to Justice Enoch's question of opposing counsel, is McKee himself covered? I don't understand.
No, McKee, and the argument has been that McKee and the CARP are one and the same. If you look at the brief, both in the Court of Appeals and in the response to the application, which is not Texas law at all. A corporate entity is separate and distinct.
But if this if McKee was driving a car that was not covered, the car he owned, is he covered?
No. There's no liability coverage here. There's no UM coverage. There's no PIP coverage. There's no coverage at all of any kind because of the facts and circumstances of this particular accident.
Well, who's covered under this?
Well, for which purpose? For liability purposes? If it had been a permissive user under the liability section of the policy, yes. But the automobile in question, the 1982 automobile, was not a covered automobile. It was not listed.
There's a section here that says there is coverage.
Property. Mr. McKee's stepdaughter was driving at the time. She was not an employee. They were not on a pursuit of corporate business. It was a personal outing. On these particular facts, there's no coverage at all. Going back to a question that was asked earlier.
I'm still not clear on that. If Mr. McKee was driving his own car, not one of the covered automobiles, is he covered by this policy?
No.
No, who is covered? Only persons that are driving covered automobiles.
Well, depends on which coverage you're talking about. There are three different coverages. There's a liability section that's bodily injury and property damage, which is under the business auto coverage part, and they have definition of who is insured for that. Then there's a definition of who is insured with each of the endorsements, the UM and the PIP. But if Mr. McKee was not a U, he was not the car, he was not the named insured, if he were driving his own automobile.
He's not insured at all under this policy.
Not this policy, but he had a personal auto policy. There were two other policies. There was a liability policy of the driver, the stepdaughter who was driving, which paid limits, liability limits, and he had his own personal auto policy, and underinsured motorist limits of $300,000 were paid in that. And this is the third policy that they say clearly provided coverage to
Mr. Mines. If I understand Mr. Halberdier's argument, the basic policy defines you as the named insured. The endorsements don't refer to the definition of you in the main policy. These endorsements start out saying this is a separate insuring arrangement. It has separate provisions. It modifies policy. And the U in that endorsement is not tied to the definition of U in the main policy. Now,
yes,
that's what I understand his argument to be.
But it is. And that's the distinction between this case and CC. In CC, there was no language in the U and your throughout this policy. In this policy, at the very beginning of the policy, it says throughout this policy, which includes the endorsements, you and your mean the named corporate entity, period. And that includes the endorsements. So you is defined for purposes of the endorsement.
Any other questions? Thank you. That concludes the argument and the final calls for the day, and the marshal will now please adjourn the court.
All rise.